Hello, I'm Ross Cambridge, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science, across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, I'm actually delighted to have, because it's good to reconnect with him after many years, and that's Professor Tim Eisen. Tim, would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Hi, Ross, and thanks very much for having me on this podcast. I'm really pleased to be here. So I'd describe myself as a medical oncologist with a foot in two camps. So I'm in the academic clinical camp. I'm a professor of medical oncology in Cambridge in the UK, and I treat patients with renal cell cancer. I used to treat patients with melanoma and lung cancer, but as time has gone on, I've needed to focus more and more, and I've focused on renal cancer. So that's one foot. And the other foot is in industry. So I currently am the VP who is the franchise head, which is a sort of jargon term for the head of the team which designs and conducts late-stage R&D trials, and I lead the team which does that for GI and GU oncology in Roche Genentech. So I like working at the interface between different sectors, and the rest of my time I spend with my family. I'm married, and my wife is a tour guide and church warden, which keeps her very busy. And if you think medicine's political, you should see the church. And my two children, my son is a digital marketer, and my daughter's at school and is a fearsome hockey goalie.
Sounds fantastic. So let's dig into some of that. Obviously, it's interesting, as I have tended to interview people who are either, you know, in clinical practice or academia or pharmaceutical industry. And so your interface is obviously the bit that we hope to get to at some point. But let's start with the young Tim Eisen. So where did you grow up and why medicine?
Yeah. So I grew up in London, and why medicine? I'm sure that my father had an influence. He didn't try to have an influence, I think. I respected him very much, and he was a doctor. He grew up in Yugoslavia and only moved to the UK when he was in his 30s. He was born in just after the First World War into the kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, and then went through Croatia, which was a puppet state really at the time, not the full state it is now, and then Yugoslavia. And he left communist Yugoslavia. I think the thing about Dad was he was liberal, middle class, and had a good sense of humor, which was not a great combination in a communist country. So he left and he came to the UK.
What year was that?
He came in 1952.
Was that still Tito running?
It was. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, what was really interesting was, you know, obviously times had been very difficult in different ways. And he actually said the most difficult time was immediately after Tito broke with the Comintern, which I believe was in 1948, because then there was tremendous paranoia about what was going to happen. And that's when he said things were at their very most difficult. And then as confidence grew, things got easier again. So
hold on, let's just try and explain that for those of us not quite so familiar with European history. So communist state that then separates from the Soviet Union as such, like an independent communist state.
Stalin had effectively conquered Eastern and Central Europe. Brotherly love, so-called, was sort of institutionalized in the Comintern. And as we have most people on this call, I think, will have know that actually that way of working really only collapsed in the late 80s and even the early 90s. Yeah. And actually the first country to go was, Yugoslavia and Albania were both very tricky for Stalin. And Tito was supported quite heavily by the Allies in the Second World War, and so there were already links. And I even today, I don't really know what my dad got up to at the time, but certainly he had no trouble coming to Britain at the time.
And so he came. You said he was a doctor, so he was a practicing clinician.
He was. He was actually in the army, and then he went into research. But life was obviously very difficult for that. Very difficult to do academic research under those circumstances. And he actually came to the UK and did a PhD with what has now become Novartis. It was the chemical industry of Bayer or Ciba at the time. And he did that at the Middlesex Hospital, which was in those days an independent hospital with a very good research reputation. And he actually went into the Department of Rheumatology, although worked quite broadly and ultimately focused on nephrology and the control of blood pressure, kallikrein, and the kinin system. And that was his main research during his life. So he really became, so he didn't practice in the UK. He was a physiologist and a scientist in the UK.
And then, so you're growing up with dad as certainly in the healthcare industry, but certainly more in the research side. What about your mum? I think you told me a fun story about how they met or something.
Yes, mum was quite a character. Both her parents had died by the time she was nine. And I think she was really looked after by her family, but they were all very young. I mean, the oldest of them was would have been 25, and they were all living in a house in Wimbledon in southwest London. And that couldn't go on. And so mum, who was the youngest, was farmed out to various maiden aunts. I think that sort of experience could make or break somebody, and it happened to make her, and she became a strong and independent person. She joined the Navy when the war broke out. Actually, she became a land army girl, first of all, and then joined the Navy. Mum was not a mathematician, I'm bound to say, so I was quite surprised to hear that she'd become, or when she told me that she'd become a coding officer in the Navy and was sent out to Alexandria to move convoys around. Unfortunately, she caught polio when she was there and was evacuated from Alexandria at the height of the Battle of Alamein and had the encephalitic part of polio at the time. And she said she could remember every bump in the road as she was evacuated to what was then called Palestine, which was a British mandate at the time. Anyway, they met in London, and various naval friends were there in London, and dad had been invited to this party too. And to give the party a bit of a swing, mum decided to dance on the piano, which, you know, if you've had polio, well, actually, probably not a very good idea under any circumstances, but it certainly isn't if you've had polio. And particularly as one of her fairly macho Royal Navy friends started to lift the lid of the piano. But anyway, all was well, and they got married not long afterwards.
Okay. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I've got one brother. He still lives in London. He's actually in the theatre world.
Oh, cool.
He's been a teacher in the theatre.
He's younger or older?
He's 2 years older than me.
Okay, because you would have thought that the terribly professional physician would be the older child and the creative one would be the younger one, but yeah. Everyone's fairly picked.
I have been told, Ross, that, you know, I was born middle-aged and I'm getting slowly younger. So, you know, you're absolutely right. It wasn't that way in our family, though.
Okay, so you said you were influenced by your dad. So when did medicine, or was it science, that sort of initially attracted you in your pathway?
No, it was definitely medicine. I liked the combination of science. I love science, and I enjoyed it. But I was also interested in the sort of psychology of how people react, how people respond to situations. I've always found that fascinating. And I think medicine is, for me, the perfect mix of these two very different ways of looking at life and understanding people. And I for me, it's been a great choice. I've really enjoyed my career, but it was the medical aspect rather than the pure science which attracted me.
I remember when we were chatting before, I was thinking you'd said that you were, as a kind of young man student, you were very bright but not very worldly. And I was thinking that one of the things that differentiates a scientist from a clinician is, I think you do need to accumulate some knocks and some failures and some, you know, quote unquote tragedies in your life to become a functional physician, because you're facing people who are going through difficult times, and it's a little hard to identify if everything's all been kind of rosy for you. So I do think we have to become worldly to become clinicians. But how did that pathway happen for you?
I think I had a certain amount of, you know, not so much worldliness as interest in the world.
Okay.
So I've always been interested in, not money per se, I'm not actually particularly interested in that, but I am interested in what money can do and enable.
Okay.
And how society actually uses its resources. And we do that mainly through the distribution of money. My mother comes from a business family, and I have always been interested in that. So I wouldn't say I was not interested in the world and in reality. I don't think I'm very good at the politics of bringing people along with you. At least I've had to work very hard at it.
Because I'm going to disagree. I actually think you're very good at the politics, but maybe what's good about it is because you're genuine about it.
Well, that's very nice of you to say so, Ross. I mean, I going into industry, you know, the sort of things that I love about industry are the can-do attitude, the urgency, the drive to get things done. What I don't like is that there is a tendency to have rather bland, high-level things, and a good proportion of people just jump up and say what a fabulous thing it is. So there is the drinking the Kool-Aid aspect of things, which I think is both unattractive and actually pretty dangerous. Because if that drive is strong enough, and there are organizations where it is a very strong drive and a very top-down organization, and depending on what the instructions coming down from the top are, you can go seriously wrong and nobody will do anything about it until it's really very late in the day. I mean, it's completely different from academia, where somebody senior says something and instantly two-thirds of people disagree. So, you know, it's a very different approach, and both have strengths and weaknesses.
As a small aside, having sat on many advisory boards for drug companies, is there are definitely ones who like to have their quote-unquote key opinion leaders who tell them what they want to hear. And they're all just sort of, you know, happily singing and laughing, heading off a cliff. Whereas I believe that I get invited back because I tell them what they need to hear, not necessarily what they want to hear.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. The only thing I would just add to that, though, Ross, is that I think advisory boards are held for various reasons. The best advisory boards are, here is something interesting, would really like you to advise us what to do next. Those are good advisory boards.
Yeah.
There are other advisory boards, which are also, from my point of view in industry, sometimes necessary. Not that we try and not have these, but sometimes you simply need somebody external to either agree or disagree with your position. Because one thing which you find when you go into industry is that the things that external experts say are treated like some sort of message from the heavens and have an immense impact, even though they may be off the cuff statements. So, you know, if I were to go back to academia ever, I would be very careful to say, you know, even a corridor conversation can be quoted.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody like you says something about lung cancer, that's going to be quoted back internally, repeatedly. particularly if it has an impact on something. So you just have to be really, that was a surprise to me. I was really surprised to see how much not only ad boards, but even interactions with an key external experts, they really can change clinical development plans. And that to me is a risk. Whereas ad boards, they're more formalized. There are rules about compliance rules about them. They are usually stage managed to a certain extent. I don't mean that people are asked to say certain things. I mean that there's a great deal of thought about what questions should we discuss, what materials should we present, what data should we present. I would say from my academic career, I actually learned personally as an academic, I often learned quite a lot from the ad boards. You get foresight of data. You usually have a good discussion. If you know you're in an ad board, which is you're purely there for some corporate reason, to agree with their pre-agreed position, it's very difficult. I found it very difficult to engage in that sort of activity. And we try not to do that. It's a waste of our time because, we don't want to have meetings simply for the purpose of another internal meeting.
Yeah.
You know, and I think those are to be avoided.
As you know, I spent a year and a half in industry as part of my training.
Yeah.
And what I was struck by was just how many meetings there were. It was like meetings about meetings and sort of action items were, let's have another meeting, you know, and it became a little frustrating. But coming back to your thing about the power of external experts, when I was working at AstraZeneca, as I was then, the internal joke was the definition of an expert was someone who didn't work at AstraZeneca. So this is
so true.
There's this elevated level of like these other people must have the truth. But it's when you can step outside the little echo chamber, they don't have any more truth than anyone else.
No, you're completely right. You are completely right. And you are also completely right that there are loads of meetings in industry, but they are different from academic meetings. So in industry, you may well, as you said, have meetings about meetings, but the final meeting will have a purpose and an outcome. And industry doesn't have the luxury usually of going round and round and round and round. There are industrial organizations which do that, but it's extremely dangerous and they may not long survive. So one of the themes I really wanted to chat with you about was this sort of feeling of ne'er the twain shall meet. And in fact, sectors like industry and academia, particularly since many people have worked in both, they don't need to behave in one way in one sector and another way in another sector. There are so many things that actually could help the other sector. So I personally think academia could learn a lot from industry.
Yeah.
And the opposite is obviously true and already happens because most people in industry have actually worked in academia at some point if they're in R&D in industry.
Yes, I was struck that the biggest thing, even though we said, you know, jokes about meetings, there is an overriding unified goal to develop a product and get it out there and, you know, meet deadlines. And I think one of the things that I really missed going from industry back to academia was the kind of lack of project management and the lack of awareness of kind of like meeting deadlines and actually deliverables.
Mm. Mm.
We're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, Tim. So we've got you as a bright young thing in London, sort of going to, I think, the same medical school as your dad was at, which...
Yeah.
Was nepotism involved? Go on, let's be honest.
No, I really don't think so. I mean, I was reasonably strong. I was a good fencer as well, which, you know, in those days in medical school, your sporting achievements were quite important. That was quite a big thing for medical school. I don't think so. I did well at medical school. The best thing about the medical school, actually, I made some nice friends who I'm still in touch with very much. But the best thing was I did something called an intercalated BSc. So in the UK, the preclinical in those days was 2 years long. And in London, you had the opportunity to do a third year and get a BSc from it. And I did something called cell pathology, which was run by a man called David Gingell. And it was fantastic. Really good people on the course. It was mostly immunology, but there was biology, cell biology in particular. And that's actually when I realized I definitely wanted to go into research. And that although I love looking after patients, I think ultimately I wanted to end up as somebody who would develop new treatments and understand the mechanisms of disease and the mechanisms of treatment. And I feel that was the most, my first really lucky strike was that. And I had a fabulous supervisor for my BSc project, who I'm still in touch with all these years later on. I'm very grateful. I mean, we all have people throughout our lives without whom we would definitely gone in a different direction. So Tony Leatham, he was one of the people who I would really count for me, has made a huge difference to my life.
So how did he make a difference?
Looking back on it, he built the confidence to do something, not because you were told to do it, like a schoolboy or a preclinical medical student in those days was often, you know, learn this, get tested on it, do this practical. This is something you need to look up and research, come up with some ideas, and we'll decide if we can do them. And he was friendly, he was encouraging, he was supportive, he was amusing, you know, and I just thought, as a role model, he was great. And I think I've never really lost the interest in the way of just following your nose. It's not necessarily easy, either in academia or in industry. And we often think, or at least as an academic, I would often have thought, industry, you have to do what you're told. You can only do the things that you're told. Well, you know, as an academic, you're assuming you need grant support. Your idea has to fit the grant, or you have to make it fit the grant. So yeah, it's always a challenge. But I think shaping your research to the available resources and doing something that ultimately makes a difference, that's what I love about research.
Yeah, I think it is an element of the art of the possible. So it's got to be have enough time and enough resource, enough funding. But then within that, there's still areas which are important and interesting that you can prioritize.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Okay, so all right, we'll do the quick. So Middlesex, BSc, and then at that point, that's when most people go do clinical medicine. And then you decided to be the salmon swimming upstream or something, you know, just like the opposite away from everyone else.
Yeah. So I did this intercalated BSc, and then so most of my pals had done are now a year ahead of me. And I also thought, and as you so kindly alluded to with your nepotistic comment.
I do like to call a spade a spade.
No, appalling. I thought it was time to cut the apron strings and probably past time to cut the apron strings. And I went to Cambridge to do my clinical, which was an unusual thing to do. In those days, most people went in the opposite direction. That's all changed now. Anyway, Cambridge in those days was already a really good place to train. It's a very good place now, a great medical school. In those days, it was rather looked down on, and it was looked down on because it was more of a district general hospital. But of course, a big general hospital is a great place to train, particularly in those days when many medical schools in the big centres in London, you would be on a firm, so a medical service, which would be specialising in something really esoteric, so that you never saw somebody with a heart attack or you never saw somebody with a stroke, because unless you were on call, those weren't the patients you looked after. And I think that I am old-fashioned in that I still believe people should be good general medics before they specialize. We have lots of very, very talented young doctors, but the thing that I do worry about is that as we become super specialized, you know, our patients don't become super specialized. Our patients are the same as they always were.
Yeah.
And you have to know enough about general medicine not to have to refer for every little thing. And I think that's a challenge. I really do.
Yeah. Well, let me try and explain to our international audience. So again, Cambridge University, very well known. There you do undergraduate medicine. So in the UK, medicine is an undergraduate degree. And then you go to a hospital to learn the clinical side. And that time, most of the flow was from Cambridge into the London medical schools that Tim just described. Whereas Tim, as we said, went from London to Cambridge, where the clinical school was not as developed as it is. I mean, technically it was a teaching hospital, but it wasn't of the grand 100-year traditions of before. Was there also a draw to Cambridge? I mean, to the whole Oxbridge thing?
Yes. I mean, I did go to a school where, you know, when people were leaving, people who'd managed to get into Oxford and Cambridge were called out and everyone else was ignored. So that wasn't great. I mean, there are many excellent universities, obviously. And I think in those days it was even more marked than it is now. So yes, it's a very exciting place to be intellectually. It's actually an exciting place to be for any young person. You know, there are lots of fun, interesting, stimulating people around and lots of great things to do. It's a very beautiful city. And yeah, I would say, you know, it's one of the great achievements of British life is, you know, the creation of excellent universities, including one of them being Cambridge. And I think it's a great privilege to go to one of them. And I'm very glad to have gone to Cambridge. And I've made some of my best friends from there who are not medics. And that's another difference. So if you go to a medical school, at least in my case, if you went to the Middlesex Hospital Medical School in those days, your friends were medics. And you went around with medics and nurses and other health professionals. And they're great, but we're similar.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, education is about broadening the mind. And the broader it gets, the more benefit that sort of education has. So I do think, you know, that I'm really pleased that although the Middlesex Hospital doesn't exist anymore, it's part of University College London, which is a university-sized college. You know, you would get a broader education or at least broader experience now than you would have done in those days.
You train in Cambridge and then you flit back to London. It's like, you know, it's like I'm going to turn left, I'm going to turn right, I'm going to turn left again. Did your medical training, specializing in oncology in the Marsden in London, and then you get called back, I think, as a professor? Was your first appointment back in Cambridge as a professor or...
Yeah.
Editor.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So I had some jobs in London. You know, I was trained there in medical oncology. I did my PhD at the Marie Curie Research Institute. And I went back to Cambridge, which had a reputation as being very strong preclinically and in the translational setting. I mean, both, I think, deserved reputations, and did not have the same reputation. It didn't have a bad reputation, actually, but it didn't have the same strong reputation in clinical medicine. And I went there to try and draw more attention to the strengths that were already there. There were, in fact, some really good people there already, and to build that up further. It was challenging, to be absolutely honest.
What year did you go there?
I went in 2006.
Comparing to America, where pretty much everyone who makes the coffee is called professor. So how many professors were there when you arrived?
Yes. So there's more coffee making now than there was then. But even so, there had been an increase in the number of professors, so that So in the old days, there would have been the head of the department. There was one professor. When I got there, there were already there was the head of the department. There was two cancer research professors. There was a professor of surgical oncology, and I was the professor of medical oncology. So, yeah, and that's just the clinical part and some of the translational part. Now, I would say there are probably twice that number because, you know, we're moving towards a more American model, but it's still, there are fewer full chairs than there are assistant professors and professors who don't have resources that go with the chair. So I was effectively responsible for trying to develop the clinical research further. And I think, as I was saying, there good things had already been done by colleagues many years before I arrived. And they were pretty welcoming. I think the big difference, though, it was very difficult to align the interests of the academics and the service personnel. So in the National Health Service. So medicine is actually delivered by National Health in the National Health Service. And some people work for the National Health Service, other people work for the university and work also in the National Health Service. And there were great difficulties about getting an alignment between the two. And in particular, that's exacerbated when you work in a department like many, it's not unique to Cambridge by any stretch of the imagination, but when you work in a department where preclinical and early translational work has the cachet, if you like,
yeah,
and clinical work doesn't. I don't think you can have a great cancer center until you correct that misapprehension, in my view. So I think that to be a great cancer center, you have to be good across the board, from basic research through translational search to clinical research and clinical service. You have to have at least all four, and you actually have to have that in multiple areas to be a truly great center. And, you know, for reasons which are sort of too multiple to go into, I think my timing was wrong. It was not possible to organize along those lines, the favored lines I've just said, in the time that I had available. And so when AstraZeneca moved one of its main research bases from Manchester to Cambridge, to the biomedical campus in Cambridge, I thought this was an opportunity really to bring, well, this is going to sound arrogant, but to bring the department up to the level that I had seen in London.
Okay.
Where there was alignment between what the, not, and it's not always smooth. I'm not saying everyone agrees with each other all the time, but there did have to be an appreciation that all of these various aspects of oncology were important, not just one or the other. I saw AstraZeneca's arrival as being potentially groundbreaking. And, you know, Pascal, I think, moved one of the main company bases because I think there was a need to shake up AstraZeneca. That was part of the rationale, I think, almost certainly. But also to build in a brand new campus. It's a very big campus with plenty of building space next to one of the world's great scientific universities, with a hospital bang next door to you, where there is the potential to have that sort of Brownian motion with, you know, people bumping into people working in different areas and have it and sparking off each other. And I think there's more to do. I would say that probably AZ has achieved that very well on the preclinical side, and on the clinical side, it's slower, it's more challenging. But I think, you know, I think things are happening, and I think that has been extremely helpful in making the Cambridge Biomedical Campus potentially one of the really great long-term assets for the UK economy.
Let's pull some of the parts. So first of all, Pascal is the CEO of AstraZeneca. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. He used to work at Genentech, Pascal Soriot. Okay. And he is an extremely driven, extremely gifted man with a scientific, you know, strong scientific understanding, as well as obviously tremendous business acumen. And not long after he took AstraZeneca over, and just to go back one step, when he took it over, it was in a pretty bad way. So there had been a lot of investment, but it was investment really in a marketing-led strategy, as I understand it. So, oh, here's an opportunity, let's develop a drug there.
Yeah.
As opposed to, this is where the science is taking us, and it might enable us to develop a drug in area X. But that has to be combined. That seems obvious. But I'll come back to this, because it wasn't necessarily the way things were done in AZ before he arrived, nor in fact is it always done like this, that you only follow the science. But if you only follow the science, you can run into a different problem, so that you can follow the science into oblivion. So that if you are developing good science, but it does not have a commercial business case, you're not going to succeed. And this is something that it's taken me some time to learn. So when I went into AstraZeneca, which was 2014, I went into the early development part of it. And I ended up working for Susan Galbraith, who's a fantastically effective leader in oncology. And I also, you know, I was mentored by Mene Pangalos, who's another great leader in the sort of drug development space. And I learned an enormous amount from them, not formal education, but just experience about what do you need to have, what do you need to know, and when do you need to know it to develop a drug. And the decision-making process is quite often frustrating, because you might have a great scientific idea and one thing doesn't stack up, usually the business case.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, you just can't do it. And also the goalposts can change. So the Inflation Reduction Act in the US has definitely moved the goalposts, so that it is altering the calculations of whether it's feasible commercially to develop a drug in space X. I think this is important, and I presume people know what they're doing.
Generous of you.
I know. But I mean, you know, everyone's very smart. You have to be smart to get to that level. And I do worry that, you know, the short-term effects may be beneficial. Because I know that in the U.S., you obviously practice in the U.S., trust, and drugs in the U.S., healthcare in the U.S. is extremely expensive. It's much cheaper in Europe, for example. Even though we complain in Europe about the cost of drugs, you know, that can be a small fraction of what you pay in the U.S.
Yeah.
And there are clearly issues which we need to work through, and I think. You know, our current system, we need to future-proof it. We need to make it sustainable, not only so that we can continue addressing the things that we're addressing at the moment, but also to make it more attractive and, you know, for those areas where there's a weak business case. So infectious diseases, for example, I think it's a truism to say that there are very, very few new classes of antibiotic or anti-infective agent. And it's partly because the business model is so difficult to make work.
Tim, before we get into that, let me backtrack a wee bit. Okay, so you're a professor of medical oncology. I'm still confused. You know, AstraZeneca arrives in your backyard, and I'm unclear as to whether this is an opportunity for Tim Eisen to say, okay, I'm going to expand my career and move into this, or were you perceiving it as somehow beneficial to the Cambridge Department of Medical Oncology at the same time. I was trying to figure out who was the primary beneficiary in your decision, and also how did you broker that decision with your various bosses?
By this stage, I'd been in Cambridge for just over 7 years, and it had been tough. There's no doubt about it, and it was getting tougher.
But you have significantly increased clinical trial accrual.
We'd had achievements, but what I couldn't see was that there was a willingness, or more worryingly, even an interest to align our scientific and clinical strengths.
Okay.
People talked about it, but only in the case of the breast unit did I see that. And actually also prostate cancer. Of those two areas, I thought they had done that.
You mean kind of bench to bedside sort of research?
Yeah, and back again. Yes. I didn't think that was going to change anytime soon.
Okay.
So when AstraZeneca arrived, you know, this was a big thing for the university as well. And AstraZeneca approached me. And then I went to Patrick Maxwell, who's a great scientist himself, and was head of the clinical school. So he was my boss's boss.
Yep.
And I suspect Patrick already knew what was going on. And so Patrick very generously said, I'll do you a deal. The deal is you go work for AstraZeneca. I'll give you a 5-year leave of absence, as long as you continue some clinical activity and you don't leave us. And that's the deal I took.
Okay.
And I think that it has had an effect. It's had an effect because although it's taken quite a long time to get there, there is certainly an appreciation now, a better appreciation of what industry has to offer. And also what industry needs and what a collaboration means. So it's not just the old style of, you know, we're having a meeting, you give us £10,000 and you can send somebody and listen to our great thoughts. That's very old fashioned. Yeah. And it took some time, not necessarily only in oncology either, for that to go. Now I think there's much more to and fro. There's much more Brownian motion, people bumping into each other and sparking off each other. So I think it is working, and I think the next generation it'll work even better. So that's encouraging. And one of the things which is different in industry is that you move around much more. In fact, if you're ambitious, you probably shouldn't stay in the same job for more than 3 years. Certainly 5 years would be enough.
Yeah.
Although I'd had a really good time in AstraZeneca, I did want to experience late-stage R&D as well. And as things turned out, an opportunity came up and I took it. So I moved to Roche in 2020.
Okay. My calculation is less than your 5 years that you'd committed.
Well, 2014 to 2020.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right.
So it was...
The math sucks. So, yeah.
So it was... No, I feel that I loved my time at AstraZeneca. I think it's a great company. And it was great also to see it from when I joined. You know, that I joined at virtually the same time when Pfizer was trying to take it over. And things were sweaty, shall we say. But then one success after another came through. And I would say, you know, something you will know much more about than I do, you know, from the clinical point of view, osimertinib, a beautiful piece of chemistry, an EGFR inhibitor, which also takes into account that one of the main mechanisms of resistance doesn't really hit the wild type EGFR receptor very hard. So I think it's a beautiful piece of chemistry. And AstraZeneca came originally from Imperial Chemical Industries, and you know, that chemical strength, that chemical know-how is still there, and I think that's fantastic heritage, and also heritage which has an impact today. when I left it, it's a strong company and is now even stronger. So it's been great. But actually going into a company and helping it to build up, I mean, I obviously had a very small part in it, but just being part of that is a great experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Roche, we're in a similar position in a way, in that Roche has been extremely prominent, you know, particularly in breast cancer, in anti-angiogenic treatment. It led the field. But in oncology, everything goes in cycles. And at the moment, we are at a point where we are now rebuilding again.
Yeah.
The immunotherapy story hasn't played out the way we would have hoped. We've still got some irons in the fire, but by and large, it's, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know to say that PD-1 lag 3 has been difficult. So the checkpoint field has been difficult, as has TIGIT, which is another checkpoint target. And we're not, unfortunately, and I mean, not unfortunately, we're not alone in this. Lots of companies are having these difficulties. I still think immunotherapy's got a long way to go. You know, the vaccines studies that we've seen are interesting. I think there's a lot more work to do, but they are definitely interesting. And cellular therapies, new ranges of treatment coming through. So it is a very exciting field, but it is a case of rebuilding the portfolio.
So Tim, when you transitioned from AstraZeneca to Roche, did you have to go back to the Cambridge boss and say, hey, you know, you remember the deal? Do we extend out the deal? Or is it now like...
Yes, I did.
You did. So you still have a foot in both camps.
I still have a foot in both camps. And I do, I have to remember which hat I'm wearing at any one time. What I tried to do, I tried to bring, for example, if I'm in an academic meeting, I tried to bring what I have experienced or known from industry. And similarly, when I'm in an industrial meeting, you know, I'm often there not because I'm doing the hard graft, but because I have the experience to advise, to ask questions, to give an opinion from an academic point of view, and also to interpret the things that people like you say, and what questions we want to ask you and how we involve people like you in our plans. So I do think it is useful to have somebody who has experience in those two fields. So, you know, when I look ahead, I think there's more to do. And in particular, wearing my university hat, I think there is an enormous opportunity in Cambridge. There will be other universities in a good position, but we have biotech on site, we have medtech on site, we have big pharma on site. We have a regulatory system which allows you to have a foot in both camps. We have a very good hospital with loads of academic facilities around us. And we have many departments, physics, astrophysics, chemistry, biochemistry, all of which are world class. So I actually think Cambridge could be an absolutely magnificent place all this interface between different sectors. And that's really the rationale. So to go back to your question, that was what I really wanted to enable me to end up doing. And I'm still in that position, that I'm looking for opportunities to build the benefit of these interfaces.
How do you deal with conflicts of interest? I mean, presumably you're still a clinician, you still do a clinic, but there must be some Roche drugs or AstraZeneca drugs that might be coming into clinical trials.
I would not be the first person to prescribe a drug for the company I was working for.
Okay.
I would not introduce a trial which was sponsored by the company I'm working for. I would, the first time I meet a patient, I inform them that I don't say, oh, there's something I've got to tell you. I weave it into the conversation.
Okay.
So that I don't want them to think I'm more interested in who I work for than I am in them, but I do need them to know that. So yes, I do have to remember my conflicts of interest. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, confidentiality, so I can't talk about a lot of the things that I do in Roche with my colleagues in Cambridge. Similarly, you know, if somebody tells me something which they want to publish, I don't spill the beans to colleagues elsewhere. But you can handle it. You do have to be open about it. And, you know, senior colleagues, as you'll be aware, have run into significant problems when they haven't mentioned sometimes. You know, in one way, it's easier working in industry because everyone assumes you're biased. You know, it makes it much easier to say, well, the data are these.
Yeah.
And I don't have to worry that you think I'm spinning a yarn because you go away and look for yourself. And it's actually easier in a way. What is more difficult is when somebody is, particularly if they're friends, you know, is asking for a bit more information than I can give. You have to be able to say, I'm really sorry, but I can't talk about that.
So if I'm a patient and, you know, forget the AstraZeneca and Roche studies, but let's say there's a study by a competing company. If I go see Dr. Eisen, what do you do? Because you can't know about some other company's study because there's proprietary information going on there.
I can, but I don't talk about it. I don't use that information.
And they don't have an issue with you being an investigator on somebody else's trial?
Well, you know, at the moment, they know who I am and who I work for. Some companies do. I couldn't, for example, be a principal investigator for anyone.
Okay.
I couldn't be a principal investigator for anyone, whether it's my company or anyone else's, but actually for different reasons, because there'd be different conflicts of interest. But I can be a sub-investigator. But they need to know about that. But I'm very, very careful not to ever talk about it or use the information that I need to be able to participate in the trial as an investigator with either in the projects that I run. It's actually relatively simple at the moment because even though I'm part of the GIGU team, I clinically treat patients with renal cell carcinoma, and we don't have a big program in renal cell carcinoma in Roche at the moment. So at the moment, I don't have those, or at least I rarely have those conflicts.
We have biotech up in Boulder, which is just sort of north of Denver here. And we had some people working for a company called OSI, and they would come down and do half a day of clinic with us. And the way we did it was they would be aware of the clinical trials and, you know, they could see the patient if they had to, but the decision to put on that trial, they had to run by a colleague. It was this kind of slightly clunky way, but again, being seen to be doing the right thing.
Yes. Actually, we go one step further. So we have a pre-clinic meeting where we discuss all 60 or 70 patients, however many there are in clinic. We go through the whole lot. And it's a good teaching opportunity as well, but it does also mean that the decision using the data we have from our electronic patient record as to what to offer the patient is made by other, not by me. It's fine for me to offer standard of care, but I am careful that I leave it to my colleagues to suggest which trial patients might go on.
Is this foot in both camps going to continue, or is presumably the university feels there's some benefit to the university to keep you under their label, or do you have any colleagues who go, that guy Eisen, he's getting, you know, his bread buttered on both sides here, you know, we don't like him?
They don't say it to my face, but
only I would say that to you.
Exactly, Ross, thanks. I wouldn't be surprised if some people think that, but most people have been very supportive. And also, you'll know this better than I do, because you've been in this position. But what I would love is that people who want to be drug developers have a period in industry. Not a very long period necessarily, but within, I think you were there for 18 months. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You probably don't even need 18 months to get the majority of the benefit. I think 18 months must have been brilliant. But I would even say 6 months minimum, preferably a year, you would know You would understand much better how industry thinks. You'd see where industry is really strong, like FinFarm. And I would have been a much better academic if I had had industrial experience as part of my training, if you want to be a drug developer. And that's what I would love to do. I'd also think that it's not just medical oncologists. I think this is true of lots of drug developers, whether they are nurses, doctors, journalists, venture capitalists, politicians. And I would love to be able to use the university's resources to create a course. I call it a course, but it's really a very high level thing, which is really more of a networking opportunity, but with a talk by somebody who really knows what they're talking about. I think that it would encourage people just to question some of their assumptions, which are unhelpful sometimes, and to understand how the other sectors think.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. The one advantage of the 18 months that I had was I had a great mentor at AstraZeneca called Andrew Hughes. And he said, you're not going to be a tourist. You're not going to be an observer. You're going to do the same work that I would if you were a new employee. So I actually had projects to run. Mm. And I think you can still gain valuable experience as kind of, you know, a more curated time. Mm. But getting your hands dirty certainly helped.
I do agree. And I think Andrew was absolutely right. And actually, Andrew is a, you know, fantastic person, developer, as well as a drug developer. And I think that won't always be possible, which is why, you know, this sort of course that I described would serve a different purpose. But yeah, for somebody training to be a drug developer, 100% agree with you that actually having a proper job for a period of time in industry, you would learn an enormous amount very quickly. You must have found it useful in your career, what you found out, what you discovered at AZ when you were there.
Well, like you said, you break down that them and us, and you get to understand that, you know, the way of making, I think, deals and collaborations is understanding the motivation of whoever you're trying to collaborate with. And there are things where there are shared interests and you focus on those, and there are things where you're going to pull in one direction, they're going to pull in the others, and you go, well, that's not where we're going to collaborate. So right. Yeah, learning the motivations behind industry and then working within those to find kind of mutually beneficial areas was, I think, a huge issue that helped me.
And I think, you know, one thing for academics, well, and another thing I am very interested in working, actually with Max Palmer, who directs the MRC, Medical Research Council Trials Unit at UCL, is industry quality studies run by academia, or maybe not industry quality, but regulatory quality studies run by academia, because I do have concerns about the sustainability of our model. I do have concerns that many academic studies ask a really important scientific question, but ultimately don't change the clinical development plan, don't change the regulatory status, because they're not of regulatory quality.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. I mean, in America, you have some great groups like SWOG, which does do regulatory quality studies, but they're... the majority of academic studies don't actually move the needle. And I think that's an enormous shame. They don't always need to move the needle, but having that ability to do so would be an enormous benefit. And, you know, there's an organization at Oxford University called PROTAS, which does this. So during COVID, for example, this group of people ran the studies to do with dexamethasone, which changed practice.
Yeah,
did it very quickly, did it very efficiently, did move the needle. And I think there's much more to do there. And again, industry experience as well as academic experience, you need to have them working together to make that difference.
I think what we've really started to see is, you know, going back to the young Tim, of that excitement about working at interfaces, which is exactly what you are doing.
You've already told us some of your ideas of what the future is going to hold, but you know, you're now, without revealing any secrets, you're just entering your, I think, sixth decade, however you defined it.
You've just revealed a secret.
I know, I'm terribly sorry, but it's because you look middle-aged from the first time I met you. The thing is, you know, what do you want the next, let's say, 5 years to bring for you, you as a person and you as a professional?
Yeah. So for me as a person, the most important thing to me is to see my children settled. Not necessarily settled in life, but settled on a path. I think that's the most meaningful thing to me personally. Professionally, yes, you are quite right. I am in my seventh decade, and I won't go on working until my eighth decade. So this is my last decade working. And what I would really like to do, whether it is in industry or in academia or a bit of both, would be to build ways of having fruitful interfaces between academia and industry. And you have to be opportunistic. So, you know, with the removal of, or our own removal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, there are concerns in this country about what is the future of our health research sector, which is a major part of our economy. And that creates an opportunity because it suddenly means that people are willing to think, well, what do we need to do to make this really successful? And I think the Academy of Medical Sciences and various bits of government are focused on this now in a way that wouldn't have been the case 10 years ago. And so I think there is the opportunity to build this, and that's ultimately what I want to do. I'm too old to, you know, develop a new drug from mechanism to, you know, clinical practice. I can't do that. But what I can do is help train the generation of people who will do that, and that's what I want to do.
Tim, that's fantastic. But then, that's always what I've liked about you. There's a bit of you, and there's an awful lot of how do I look after the next generation. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Best of luck in the endeavors.
Thank you very much, Ross. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. All the very best.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Camidge. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or follow us at DrCamidge on X for additional commentary.